The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
It's Monday, March the 31st. I'm Matt Wells. Today, what next for Zimbabwe as the opposition claims a sweeping election victory over Robert Mugabe?
You have to remember that more than half the population was born after he came to power, so this is the only leader they've ever known. They've also had experience of previous elections that were rigged.
The cost of the credit crunch, thousands of city workers could lose their jobs. Plus, the chaos at Terminal 5 continues, and if you can't get to the funeral of a faraway friend, watch it on your computer instead.
I don't believe everyone will be attracted to it. There will obviously be a percentage of people who think that it's not the done thing, so to speak. You know, you shouldn't webcast funerals, it's very personal. But we live in a world where family members live all over the place now. So it's just another option to allow people to be part of the service without actually coming here.
That's all coming up later. First, the main news of the day and a look at the morning papers with Bill Overton.
Zimbabweans are still waiting for an official result in their country's presidential elections. Riot police are on the streets of the capital Harare following claims of victory by the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. President Robert Mugabe is seeking a sixth term in office amid widespread claims of vote rigging and voter intimidation. More on this to come in Guardian Daily. Investigators are to begin removing the bodies of five people killed in a plane crash in Kent. They'll be attempting to find out what caused the tragedy. Ex-touring car champion David Leslie and racing team owner Richard Lloyd are believed to be among the dead. No survivors were found at the scene of the crash, which destroyed part of a housing estate in Farnborough. The damaged house was empty at the time, and there were no reports of injuries on the ground. The government could face a legal challenge from its own human rights watchdog. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission's concerned about plans to extend the limit for detention without charge of terror suspects to 42 days. The crucial second reading vote takes place tomorrow, and Home Secretary Jackie Smith believes the plans will get through the House of Commons. The mother of Scarlett Keeling, the 15-year-old raped and murdered in Goa last month, is due to return to Britain today with her daughter's body. Fiona McEwan plans to have more forensic tests carried out on Scarlett's body when they arrive in the UK. The teenager was on holiday with her family, who are travelling elsewhere in the region, when she was killed. In football, Liverpool emerged as victors from one of the most hotly anticipated Merseyside derbies in recent years. An early Fernando Torres goal was enough to see off Everton and strengthen Liverpool's hold on fourth place in the Premier League. In yesterday's other matches, Chelsea beat Middlesbrough by 1-0, and Newcastle won 4-1 at Spurs. Turning to today's papers, and nearly all the front pages feature large pictures of the wreckage of that plane in Kent. The FT, though, leads with news that George Bush and Gordon Brown have agreed to step up cooperation over the crisis in financial markets. The Telegraph has more gloom to report on the credit crunch. It quotes a leading economist who says that a fall in house prices of up to 25% is entirely plausible within the next 2 years. The Times and The Express both lead on changes to Britain's car parking fine system. The Times says that drivers will now get the benefit of any doubt. The Express, though, maintains that parking fines chaos starts today. For breaking news throughout the day, visit guardian.co.uk.
The main opposition party in Zimbabwe has claimed an overwhelming victory in the national elections. The Movement for Democratic Change says there's no way that President Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party can claim victory unless it's through fraud. The MDC based its claim on unofficial tallies by its own observers at polling stations across the country. It defied a ban on declaring early because the last time, in 2002, it's widely believed the results were fixed when they were collated centrally by the Electoral Commission. The Guardian is one of the few foreign news organisations with a reporter in Harare, and we'll hear from Chris McGreal in a moment. Over the years, many local journalists who defy the government have been forced to leave the country. Wilfum Banger now edits the Zimbabwean newspaper from neighbouring South Africa. He says the people of Zimbabwe are hoping that this time their votes will count.
They're expecting change. In fact, you know, I've been getting incredible reports from all around, you know, all our reporters. You know, people in the rural areas who were putting out the MDC sign or shouting MDC slogans and so on, and being told by the police to shut up. And they told them, shouted back, you know, you are as hungry as we are, you know, go away. and they went away. This would have never happened a few years ago.
Wilfred Banger. Now, our reporter, Chris McGreal, is in Harare, and he says the opposition has claimed victory by a significant margin.
They're claiming to have won about 67% of the results that are in so far, about one-third of them. But there are other figures which suggest that that's a little high, a much broader sample, about 66% of the vote in, suggests that the opposition will probably take about 55%, with Robert Mugabe on about 37-38%. That's still a significant victory, and that still means that the opposition candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, would win outright without a runoff.
So what will Mugabe do given this result?
Well, it's very hard to say at the moment. I mean, what perhaps indicates the sense of alarm that must be going through this government is that the official electoral commission hasn't issued a single result. It's now 24 hours since the polls closed. In the last election, they pretty much wrapped up issuing the results within 9 hours. And the commission's gone to ground. The head of the commission, when we asked him why there have been no results, he simply said this is a very complicated election. The opposition fears that what that means is that they were planning to fix the results, but that the opposition victory has been so overwhelming they don't know how to do it. What Mr. Mugabe will do is completely unclear. I would imagine that given the scale of the opposition victory, and to be honest, not just against Mugabe, but against members of ZANU-PF, at least 8 members of the Politburo have lost their seats in Parliament, including the Vice President and the Defence Minister. This is a pretty firm rejection of this ruling party. I'd have thought that Mr. Mugabe would have a very hard time persuading the military and even his own party that he should hang on to power in the face of such a rejection.
You mentioned the military, Chris. I guess key to what happens next is what their reaction will be.
Yes, and there are some indications from within the MDC that they put out feelers to the military to try and ensure that despite the comments by the army chief before the election that he would never salute Morgan Tsvangirai as president, but in fact the military recognizes this is the will of the people and they stand aside. It might be that there's room for negotiation. There's certainly people in the army who are very professional, but there are also those who would feel vulnerable to prosecution for crimes committed here and in other places, particularly in Congo. And I would have thought that there's the potential, at least, for negotiated middle ground, recognising opposition victories in return for amnesty, for instance. That's certainly an area I would imagine the MDC will be exploring right now.
What about internally within Robert Mugabe's own party in ZANU-PF? Because there were attempts made to get rid of him before, weren't there?
Yes, indeed. It's in fact been very divided. One of the reasons that the third opposition candidate, Simba Mokoni, ran and didn't do particularly well was that he broke away from ZANU-PF. He was Mugabe's former finance minister. Was that he was very unhappy that Mugabe had imposed himself last October as the party's candidate to be president for a sixth term. Many people in the party felt that Mugabe, after 28 years, had ruled for long enough. Many people felt that, in fact, he was going to be a very bad candidate for the party, as has been proven by the election. Once Mokoni announced he was going to run, that split the party. Some publicly went over to him, some quietly went over behind the scenes. But it's a very, very divided ruling party, and that has probably contributed to the scale of its defeat.
And as we await the reaction from Robert Mugabe himself, what's the mood on the streets?
One of wariness, really. It's a mixture of people not being quite able to believe that the opposition appears to have such a decisive victory, and also not quite being able to believe that Robert Mugabe, after 28 years, will simply leave. You have to remember that more than half the population was born after he came to power, so this is the only leader they've ever known. They've also had experience of previous elections that were rigged, although on a much smaller scale than would have to be the case if this one were to be stolen. But people, there have been some celebrations, but most people feel it's too early to celebrate until it is confirmed that President Mugabe is prepared to step down.
Chris McGreal speaking to us from Harare last night. You can read the latest from Zimbabwe at guardian.co.uk/world. Also on the Guardian website today, the UK Human Rights Watchdog says the government's plans to increase the pre-trial detention period to 42 days is illegal. That's at guardian.co.uk/politics. And on our sports site, there are reports on all the weekend action, plus William Fotherington reflects on a fantastic result for Britain in the World Cycling Championships. The credit crunch is not only going to affect homeowners. The CBI says today that thousands of city workers could lose their jobs. The Guardian's business editor is Deborah Hargreaves.
The latest survey by the CBI and PricewaterhouseCoopers has shown that a lot of city firms are looking at cutting back on jobs, and they estimate about 11,000 jobs will go in the city as a result of the credit crunch.
And I guess it sounds harsh, Deborah, but many people probably won't feel that much sympathy for these people because there's a perception that they caused the problems that we're now facing.
Absolutely. I don't think people feel much sympathy for bankers. And when you think that they took a lot of risks at the height of the boom, they've all walked away with multi-million pound payouts. And now if they lose their jobs, I don't think we'll lose much sleep over it.
This survey is quite a wide-ranging survey as well, isn't it? And it's showing that that the mood in the city is pretty grim.
It is. I mean, it doesn't just cover banks. It covers insurance companies and all other financial firms as well. And it's found that optimism has dropped really sharply. Employment and profits have fallen at the sharpest rate for 5 years. And most people expect the credit crunch to be much worse than they initially expected, to last at least another 6 months and possibly longer than that.
Well, we suggested that there would be little sympathy for people who lose their jobs. One of those was Adam Applegarth, of course, the former chief executive of Northern Rock. And there's been stories this weekend about the amount of the payoff that he received.
Yes, it looks like he's going to get a payoff of £760,000. That should be announced today when the Northern Rock results come out. We were initially told that he was in for a payout of half that, which would be 6 months' salary. It now seems that he's in for a payout of a year's worth of salary paid each month over a year unless he gets another job. This is obviously a big reward for failure from a bank that's now owned by the government.
Well, I was going to say that in effect we've nationalised Northern Rock. Does this mean that the government can get its money back from him?
Well, I don't know, because this is now taxpayers' money that's being used to pay him. Northern Rock isn't making any profits itself. A lot of its money has gone in paying fees for advisors, banks and PR consultants during the time when it was looking to sell itself. And Applegarth has obviously got a contract that involves him receiving a year's payout.
And it's not likely that he's going to get another job in a year anyway, so he'll probably get the full lot, I
imagine. Don't think so. Now,
we heard last week about regulatory changes that Alistair Darling is making in response to the credit crunch and the fallout from all of that in Britain. And it looks today as if we're going to get similar announcements from the US. Is that right?
Yes, it looks like today the Fed will announce a huge shake-up in the way it regulates banks. And the US government will seek to clamp down on regulation. The Fed, up till now, hasn't really had a responsibility for monitoring investment banks. That's been with the Securities and Exchange Commission. But it looks like it will now get that power. And that means now that it's bailed out Bear Stearns, the fifth biggest investment bank in the US, it will be able to increase its regulation of all the others. There's all sorts of other regulatory changes happening in the US. It should be a really big announcement.
OK, we'll look out for that. Deborah Hargreaves, thanks very much. I'm Matt Wells, and you're listening to Guardian Daily. Coming up...
You can hear the hoofbeats pound as they raced across the ground, and the clatter of the wheels as they spun round and round.
Why that Benny Hill song is a hit at a Southampton crematorium. But first, the misery bestowed upon those BA passengers unfortunate enough to be travelling through Terminal 5 at Heathrow Airport in London continues today. BA says the baggage system is now working and it's trying to reunite some 15,000 bags with their owners. But more flights have been cancelled today, and at the weekend, BA drafted in volunteers from other parts of the company in its attempt to try and get to grips with the problem. Although whether Andy from accounts will have any better idea of how to use the system than the trained baggage handlers is unclear. Our transport correspondent Dan Milmo says the disruption will last until well into this week.
BA have already said that they're going to be cancelling 54 flights today and 54 flights on Tuesday. So they can't even guarantee that it will end then. So we're likely to see it last throughout the week.
Does BA indeed have any idea about how long it might take, because the problem that they've got is that they're struggling to clear a backlog of, what, about 15,000 bags?
Yes, the BA are struggling to clear this backlog of bags, which they say is separate to operating what is effectively running to standstill operation on the baggage system itself. So they're trying to get to know this baggage system now and do little repairs and sort of change the way they operate on it simultaneously with clearing this bag mountain. It just means it's going to take a lot of time. It is possible by the end of the week that they'll be more familiar with it, but so far the signs have been very bad.
And the signs are bad, you say. So the problem is they're operating a reduced timetable. They're trying to clear bags, but they can't even cope with a reduced timetable. So how are they going to be able to cope when Terminal 5 is running at full tilt?
Terminal 5 runs at full tilt from April the 30th, and Willie Walsh, the BA chief executive, did admit last week that he's going to have to put that under review, because they've not even managed to do a soft launch of Terminal 5 over the past week. It's operating at far below capacity with these many cancelled flights. So imagine what it's going to be like going from 30,000 passengers a day currently to 70,000. That's double the amount of demand on a baggage system that they cannot operate.
So at the end of the month, what's due to happen at the moment is that they're going to move all the rest of the flights that are currently, at Terminal 4?
Yes.
And so is there any chance that that could be delayed, or are there plans then to use other airlines in Terminal 4 after the BA have moved out?
Yeah, the plans at Heathrow are well-set, long-standing plans. T5 has been years in the making. So what they've drawn up is an intricate series of schedules to move airlines into Terminal 1, BA's former home of its domestic flights, and Terminal 4, the home of its long-haul flights. So we've got lots of airlines queuing up to replace BA, which is now having to turn around and say, we can't move home just yet because we're struggling to fit into our new one.
And there's just no chance, is there, Dan, that they might go for the nuclear option and abandon Terminal 5 for the moment and put everything back to where it was? Can't they do that?
No, they cannot do that, physically as well as legally.
So BA have just got to struggle on with what they've got and hope for the best, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly what BA have to do.
OK, so it's bad news for BA at Terminal 5. Is it good news for airline passengers elsewhere? I understand that the EU Open Skies policy starts today, Dan.
Yes, the Open Skies Treaty liberalises air traffic between the European Union and the US. What it means is that any airline registered in the European Union can fly to any destination in the US. That was not previously the case. For instance, between Heathrow Airport and JFK Airport, only four airlines from the UK and US, Virgin Atlantic and BA on our side, were allowed to fly that route. What happens from today is anyone, all comers, can fly on those routes.
It depends, I guess, so long as they can get the slots. So does this mean, will we see more airlines and more competition between Britain and Europe and America?
Yes, between London airports and New York alone, you're going to see 8,000 more seats flown per week from this summer onwards. That's a lot of competition, and that will inevitably mean lower prices for passengers.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
The distress of losing a friend or loved one can be compounded if you can't get to their funeral, perhaps because of the distance involved. A crematorium in the south of England hopes to alleviate this with a new service that allows the funeral to be shown on the internet. The dead person's family can pay £75 for a username and password that can be shared with anyone who can't make it. Only those with the login details would be able to watch. Our reporter Stephen Morris went to Southampton Crematorium for a demonstration.
My name's Trevor Matheson, the manager of Southampton Crematorium.
And we're in the chapel here.
Yeah, we're in the East Chapel. We have two chapels here. This is the larger of the two.
And in the corner over there, there's a camera, which is not something you see in every chapel. Talk me through why that's there, please.
Right, no, it's not something you see in every chapel. What you're actually looking at is a DV camcorder, basically, which is hooked up to the computer systems here, and we actually use it for webcasting services onto the internet. Now, we don't actually just put these onto the internet so anyone could watch. You know, it has been suggested to us that this is quite a strange thing to do, because people think that they'll be able to log onto a site and sit there all day watching funerals, but it doesn't quite work like that. There's a lot of security involved with it. We only webcast if the family request it. Every webcast has got a username and a password. So the security's there.
So the funeral will take place here. The camera will capture that. It'll be streamed onto the internet. Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically, it's not automatically streamed. It's, as I said earlier, and I really want to make a point of saying this, that it is just a case of we only webcast when requested. I don't believe everyone will be attracted to it. There will obviously be a percentage of people who think that it's not the done thing, so to speak. You know, you shouldn't webcast funerals. It's very personal. But we live in a world where family members live all over the place now. So it's just another option to allow people to be part of the service without actually coming here.
Has anybody said it's a bit macabre to be doing this?
Yes. We've had quite a few people say that.
Is it expensive, this service, then?
Is it expensive? It depends how you look at it, yeah. £75 to a lot of people would sound expensive. And I must admit that I wouldn't spend £75 on a DVD or something like that. But this is slightly different. We're not talking about a blockbuster where you're going to sell 4 million copies or something like that. You know, we're talking about a one-off thing, you know, and all the expense that we've, you know, our overheads, the cost of installing the equipment, has all got to be put onto this one service. You know, so it, you could say it sounds expensive, but for what it is, I don't believe it is expensive.
You can hear the offbeats pound as they raced across the ground, and the clatter of the wheels as they spun round and round. Then he galloped into Market Street, his badge upon his chest. His name was Ernie, and he drove the fastest milk cart in the West. They were Ernie and Lockwood.
As if to prove the point that people already are jazzing up their funerals, Benny Hill's song Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West, chimes up in the background. It often gets played here, as Benny Hill lived just down the road. They're rehearsing for the next funeral, so we take refuge in Mr. Matheson's office, and on his PC he shows me a funeral that was recently webcast.
So we trust our sister Joan, God's mercy.
What we're looking at the screen now is we're actually on the Wesley Music website, and we've gone into the service broadcast area where we're actually watching a service that took part at this crematorium a week ago. They leave them online, still password protected, for a week. So as if anyone did miss it or didn't realise it was being webcast, they can actually watch it after the actual funeral.
And I asked inside the chapel whether people were jazzing it all up. This looks a very sombre occasion still.
Yes, it is. It's not jazzing it up. You're seeing it actually as it happens in within the chapel. Cremation services, the way they look hasn't changed at all.
Gary Philbrick, and Area Dean of Southampton.
So what do you think of this move down at the Crem?
I think there are a lot of good things about it. It's quite often people have relatives or friends who can't come to funeral services, and there's been no way in the past of people being able to share in that. So there may be some issues about it, but a lot of good points as well, I think.
What sort of issues?
There are issues of copyright, because anything that's recorded and duplicated may come under copyright law. I mean, that's largely for the crematorium and Wesley to sort out. And there are also issues the fact that they're recording people doing the service, both the minister leading the service and other people taking part.
Will it make you do anything different in there when you're...
But not, I hope not, for me personally. I mean, every funeral service we take is special. And I hope we already try to make it special. And the fact that it's being recorded, I don't think will make a lot of difference.
Dean Gary Philbrick ending that report by Stephen Morris. The number of teenagers under the age of 18 going to English universities is on the increase. It seems that bright pupils are sitting A-levels earlier, and enthusiastic parents with so-called child prodigies are pushing them harder. But university bosses are worried about the trend. They say it's not good for children to go to college so early. Our education editor, Polly Curtis, is on the line.
There's now more than 8,000 under-18s at university, compared with less than 5,000 in 2002.
And what sort of age are these? How early are people going to university?
Well, they don't break the age down any further than just saying under-18s. Anecdotally, when you talk to the main universities involved, they'll say the overwhelming majority are 17 when they start. They start a year early. But so there are figures that show that there are 100 who are under 16 when they start.
And these are presumably the child prodigies that we hear so much about. Are they applying to any particular universities?
Well, it's definitely the Russell Group of top institutions, Oxford, Cambridge, Warwick, Bristol, these kind of places. And that's because if you are a child prodigy, you're going to go to the best university rather than perhaps your local
I guess. I guess you are. Are there any disadvantages? Are there concerns that the universities have about particularly younger people, younger teenagers going to university?
They don't like it at all. They're very nervous about it because it gives them kind of parental responsibility for students, and they're not interested in that. They just want to get down to the academic work. So universities traditionally have been very kind of wary of this and really tried to put kids off as much as possible. But in 2006, there was a change in the anti-discrimination laws, which made it illegal to discriminate according to age, which meant that they now have to consider all applications regardless of age, which they're not entirely comfortable with.
And there have been a number of prominent child prodigy cases in the past few years, haven't there? And not all of them have had happy times at university.
Well, the most famous is probably the case of Sophia Yusuf, who nearly graduated from Oxford in 2000, and she was 15 when she started, and she got to her third year in 2000 and ran away, and there was this huge police hunt for her. There was a lot of press interest, and when she was eventually found, she blamed her parents for being too pushy. Meanwhile, she had a younger brother and sister who were 17 and 12 and studying at Warwick University. They did graduate a couple of years later in 2002, and when I talked to Warwick about the situation there, they said it was very challenging. They wouldn't want to do it again, but they'd avoid it like the plague, really. And that's because they felt so responsible for these very young people, and they also had to kind of deal with a lot of attention from the press. You have to go through all the legal processes of having people's criminal records checked to work with younger people. So it is quite a tricky process for universities, I think.
Okay, Polly Curtis, thanks very much. That's it from this edition of Guardian Daily. We're available for download from 7:30 a.m. BST every day. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.